Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome, Dr. Sarah Hughes, to Just Not Good Enough. Thank you so much for coming on. I've just saying a bit before we started, I wish you were here. But anyway, that's by the by. Because conversations are slightly different on Zoom, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Mm. They are, for sure. Mm. And I mean, I think it's, you know, being face to face feels like, being face to face now feels like a treat rather than something we do automatically, right?
Given what we've just been through, yeah, you're right. Now, you are CEO of Mind. You've had a career in charities, social work, and the prison service. On the right side, I might add. So you've been through frontline delivery, and you're now in positions of leadership, which is fantastic. But over the years, you've seen serious discrimination against you, I think, and others, particularly in members of your family. And this sort of came, I guess, because your grandparents emigrated from Ireland and South Africa, respectively, many, many years ago. But ironically, they were trying to escape discrimination, only to come over here. You know, I mean, bloody hell.
I know, the mind boggles.
It does, doesn't it? You've experienced poverty, homelessness, and mental health issues, which is obviously what we're all about here. And then you hate being called real when other other people find out you're a CEO. I'm sorry for laughing, but I can understand that. I mean, for Christ's sake. You're from North London. You've got a Cockney accent. I was born in Potter's Bar, actually, which is, not far from you.
Not far?
No.
I'm Finsbury Park through and through.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. I know Finsbury Park reasonably well. Anyway, you wear tattoos, although I can't see. Is that right?
I do, yes.
Oh, nice one. So you're not really a traditional CEO, are you? Which actually makes it fantastically interesting. I imagine that you say it as it is, and I suspect
it gets me into trouble sometimes.
Well, you know, that's not such a bad thing, is it? So I suspect we're really going to find out whether that's true or not. So Sarah, welcome. I talked a little bit earlier then just about your grandparents. Went to Glasgow. You got Irish, South African immigration, both from countries that actually have suffered from the English over history. You know, for various reasons. So it's interesting that they wanted to come to England. But did that family background, set in motion, if you like, your sense of social injustice?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it feels like it's part of my DNA. I was brought up with this profound understanding of what happens to people that are outside of what society considers to be the norm for any reason. It could be that you look different, you've got a different accent. And I remember, you know, probably as young as 3 and 4 years old,
wow,
remembering my grandparents talking about their experience of coming to England and the profound disadvantage and the discrimination, the famous signs on the door say no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. And that was imprinted. So I very much have that kind of rolling around my mind as a kind of motivator for what I do now, for sure.
But it's shaped your whole life, hasn't it? So, I mean, I live with mental health as well. And through therapy, I found out that actually it all goes back to your childhood, which generally it does. And I think it's what 75% of people experience mental health start before the age of 18. So, but it has, you've really been garnered by it, haven't you?
I have. And I think also my dad, who sadly died 12 years ago, also in part to the kind of inequality and injustice that people with mental health challenges experience. But yes, it's a lens that I can't unsee it. When you've felt discrimination so deeply, when you've seen it, when you've really been on the edges of that social injustice, it's me and my friends often talk about it as the third eye that you can't close.
Yeah.
You know, once it's opened, that's it. And so now everything that I, you know, every part of my life is through that lens. And, you know, we laugh all the time, me and my husband, who've been together for 30 years.
Oh, congratulations.
We both come from the same part. You know, we were both born into poverty. We were both, you know, from deeply working class families in North London. And then we've got our own kids who are posh.
Oh,
So we've
that's
got
an
fairly posh
interesting
kids, right?
dynamic.
Because I live a sort of middle class life
Yeah,
now because
yeah.
I'm, senior and I have my own home and so on. So we often look at each other and look at our kids and think, my God, they're so different from us.
Is
Their
that a good
worldview is going to be so
thing?
different.
Is that a good thing?
Sometimes, although I think we've done quite well, I remember this time I went to San Francisco and I went to what's I've suddenly forgotten the prison island. Alcatraz.
Alcatraz, that's right. That's where
So I went to
Burt Lancaster
Alcatraz on a bit
was.
of a trip and I brought back to my home this sign that says, we will provide you with accommodation and food and a safe bed, but everything else is a privilege. And my daughter, who was probably about 7 at the time, actually in a moment of brilliance said to me, but mum, you know very well that all of that is a privilege because there are people in this world that don't have any of
Wow.
that. So all
Seven
of that is a
at
privilege.
seven.
And I thought,
Yeah. You said
you
yeah,
might be
'cause
posh,
yeah,
but
but
you're all
no,
right.
your values and how you grow up and the attitudes that you have, it doesn't really matter where you come from, does it? It's about who you are and how
Exactly.
you behave. Brilliant,
Indeed.
brilliant. So you started your career as a peripatetic mental health worker. And that's such a hard word to say. And I'm a trustee of National Star Charity in Gloucestershire, which looks after really complex and multiple disabilities, kids around sort of 16 to 25. And it's just the best thing I do. And they have peripatetic nurses as well. In Haringey, oh no, sorry, and then you went to 6 years at Mind. So you were at Mind quite early on.
Yeah, so I got my first job in mental health when I was 15. It wouldn't happen now, right? But basically, I lived in Finsbury Park, and my dad knew this bloke who ran a home for people with mental health difficulties who'd been discharged from hospital. And then I sort of did some activity coordination there. So basically, I'd go there on a Saturday, and I was just a befriender for people with mental illness. So that was my first foray into proper work. And then at 18, I got my first job with Mind in Haringey. And I remember probably 2 days in feeling like I'd come home, like I knew, I understood the organization's values, I believed in what we were doing. And ever since, I believe in Mind. You could cut me open and you will see the brand probably
Yeah,
all the way through like
yeah.
a stick of rock. But yeah, it was extraordinary. And so I've worked with Mind at different local mines probably at least 70% of my career
Yeah,
as an adult.
it's a fabulous organisation, like all charities, frankly, because, well, we're going to come on to this, but about the injustice and the difficulty of funding and all of that sort of stuff. Now, you're very well qualified, actually. You're a doctorate. And a degree in organizational something, wasn't it? What did I read? Understanding organizations and a doctorate in women's resilience and leadership. Why, when you've got such a strong value set, was it necessary to do something like that?
That's such a great question. And it's very much to do with class,
I thought you were going to say
right?
that.
That's the reality of it.
Yeah.
So I very early on felt like the way I spoke, the way I looked, all those sorts of things were actually very relevant to how people experienced me and how I could be respected in environments. And certainly when I started to get a kind of much more national profile, it's very easy to undermine people, it seems, who aren't considered to be part of the glitterati, for want
Yeah,
of a better
yeah,
word.
yeah.
And I just felt like I needed some academic credibility. I'm not
Isn't that a
academic by
shame?
nature,
Isn't that a shame?
actually.
That's such a shame.
I
I mean,
know,
why?
I know.
Oh, just why can't you be? What you achieve, what you do, how you deal with people, how why do you need that piece of paper that gets you through a door?
I know, and absolutely. And in many respects, I'm, you know, I feel cross with myself for having to go through it. But in a way, I'm also curious, right? So I also like being a student and I like learning and I love all of that. In fact, I've never been to one of my graduations almost. So I've got about 4 degrees now and I've never had a graduation. And partly that is because I just think I don't want the pomp and the, you know, all of the stuff around it, because what was important for me was to do the learning and then go and apply it and live it in my real life. However, I am this week, I've been given an honorary doctorate from my first university, and I am for the first time going to be, you know, experience a graduation. So I'm very excited about it. And so I do understand the tension, you know, on one hand, being authentic as a leader should be the most important thing. The reality is that it has to probably be a little bit of both, because you need that credibility in those spaces before they're even going to look at you sideways as somebody who's great or who could offer insights. But believe me, I definitely fight it.
I'm sure you do.
Every level.
I'm sure you do, because I mean, the more I think about it, I just think it's just, you know, so what? You know, and qualifications and education aren't right for everybody. You know, my son went to university and he did well. They both did well, actually. But, you know, he hasn't used his degree at all.
Great
experience, teaches you how to think, but you can sort of do that just by learning. Can't you?
Well, indeed. Yeah. And I think, you know, I would say that my leadership or my understanding about mental health services or what people need doesn't come from the academic work that I've done. It's come from the work that I've done with real people. It's come from my own lived experience. It's come from, you know, being with that person at A&E at 3 o'clock in the morning when they've self-harmed. You know, so that's where my best learning has come from, without a doubt. There's no two ways about it.
Because one of the things at National Star is that everything we do is to do with the kids and getting them to learn life skills, basically, and living and be citizens in the world in charge of their own lives, I think, is the mantra. And it sort of doesn't matter what else goes on, as long as everything is pointing in the right direction towards benefiting that child.
Well, indeed. And I just think about my own children. And I remember before I had children, I had them quite late, but they're 14 and 11 now. And I remember before I had my kids, I remember thinking, I want them to be great, you know, academically. I want them to be really successful and I want them to be ruling the world by 16, you know. And then you have children and you realise the most important thing is that they're happy and healthy, right?
Yeah.
And how do we create the conditions for them to thrive? And so that now is the priority. It's our priority as parents. It's our priority with the work that we do at Mind. This is not about saying this is what a perfect human being looks like. This is about how do we create the social conditions in wherever you are, work, school, home, for you to thrive and for you to not be at risk of having mental illness because of the circumstances you're in.
Yeah, because I think somewhere, I think it's something that you wrote actually, that, you know, we're in the midst of a mental health crisis, and you know, we absolutely are. And let's face it, it's not going to get any better soon. I mean, it's fantastic that we're talking about it and that, you know, we're speaking on it today. But there are so many pressures for kids around the place that, you know, and social media has got to be one of the worst possible influences on children of a certain age.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I do think, I mean, I'm really pleased to hear your kind of compassion and sympathy for the way our children have to live their lives now, because you often feel, you know, people like, I'm a Gen Xer and Gen Xers and boomers, maybe.
You're too
young. Our view is, you know, kids have got it easy. They've got it easy nowadays. You know, it's easier than when I was a kid. And I just think that's just not true.
No, it
right?
is not
and
true.
And it's just not true. And I look at my children and I think about the schools that they're in, which isn't great. You know, their policies don't really enable them to thrive. They're all about kind of punishment and behaviours. I think about social media. And whilst the evidence doesn't prove that social media is the cause of the deterioration in children and young people's mental health, it has got a kind of role to play, right? And so we still don't even know the truth of it. We don't really know what role it has to play. But we think about the cost of living crisis. An organisation did some research a few years ago and found that the increase in the self-harm rate in young girls wasn't to do with social media. It was to do with poverty.
Oh.
So
is that because they can't afford to do the things that they're seeing other people do on social media?
I think it's because they'll be living in, you know, poor accommodation. They will be living in food poverty. They will be seeing their parents struggle. So it's not just because they won't be able to get the best trainers.
Mm.
This will be because, you know, when we think about, you know, 1 million children living in poverty, what we're talking about poverty is we mean not being able to have 3 meals a day, not being able to have shoes. You know, we hear stories in today's, you know, I mean, this is 2024.
I know.
We are the UK and we've got children sharing shoes so that kids can go to school. That's not a made up story.
I'm it's a bit awkward to be dumbfounded on a radio show, but you know, we're supposed to be talking and chatting about this, but that is just staggering. In first world country, top 6 or 7 in the world in terms of GDP and all of that, and we've still got 1 million kids who are poor and living in poverty.
Our levels, we are in the company of countries that are considered third world in terms of, if you look at UNICEF, they will tell you that our poverty is, I think, close to, you know, Yemen, people living in the worst parts of Turkey.
Really? Oh, oh no, yeah. I didn't want to hear that.
And I'm afraid, you know, we in the UK, I don't think, and this is something I feel really strongly about, because again, sometimes you'll hear people say, poverty, they don't know poverty. Well, I'm afraid that quite a lot of the poverty that our children, young people are experiencing is hidden.
Yeah. That's like mental health issues, isn't it? They're hidden until it's getting better. And I think people are talking more and more about it. And I guess the work that you do at Mind goes a long way to doing that. But, you know, I'm particularly interested in mental health in business, and particularly at senior levels, because having been CFO of Superdry many years ago and getting fired and then going through 10, 12 years of hell, that is really unseen. And particularly at the senior levels, where you get in a board meeting, you close the doors, and the behaviour can be absolutely bloody appalling. And you know, you get savaged, and people who aren't strong enough, actually that's not the right word, who live with a mental health issue, which I didn't know about at the time, really, really struggle with that. I mean, what's it like to work at Mind, having said that?
Well, look, you know, I would never dye my hair again, you know, just I'm full blown grey now, you know, just let it go. The reality is these jobs are hard.
Yeah.
They're hard.
Yeah.
They are relentless. They are unforgiving. They are and I think that's really interesting, the point about the boardroom. And I don't think we can underestimate the impact of the boardroom on the chief exec or the leadership team.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, whether you're in a charity or whether you're in a kind of corporate, some of those things are to a greater or lesser extent the same. I mean, I certainly don't think that in most charities you would find some of the brutality you might find in a very kind of, you know, corporate environment. But you can still find insidious and undermining behaviours. So I think that's true. I also think in today's kind of hyper-vigilant, hyper-scrutinised environment, leaders and senior leaders are hugely vulnerable. And this is not a woe-me story. I've spoken about it a lot, actually, about, you know, being a leader on social media. I mean, I don't block people on social media, but I did block somebody the other day because my line is, you can definitely challenge me, you can disagree with me, but you can't call me names.
No, don't abuse you. No.
I have that. So, but we have to tolerate quite a lot of that before you get to a point where you think, okay, right now I have to block that. It's that's unacceptable. And I think that, so there's that. I think there is the pressure around not showing vulnerability and being the strong one. And especially at the moment where the, you know, it's not just a perfect storm, it's a perfect hurricane, right, of stuff that's going on that we're dealing with. And I think that that kind of relentless or toxic resilience is problematic. You know, we can cope, we'll keep going until we can cope.
Well, I mean, that sets you up for a fall, doesn't it? Basically.
Completely.
You know, because that's what happened to me. I mean, I always thought, you know, I used to suffer with mental health things, and I have this clinical depression, which switch goes off in my head, and that's it. I've disengaged for however long it lasts. And it can be 2 or 3 hours, or it can be 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And you can't deal with that sort of behavior in a board meeting when you're feeling like that. You know, and I used to think, I'll be all right in 2 days. And you come back and you are. And you think, that's it, I'm so resilient. But it's not. It's a vulnerability that has been exposed. And you're talking about being challenged. Being challenged is absolutely fine. I don't have any problem with that whatsoever. It's the behaviour and the respect or lack of that people give you when you're challenging you, you know, and abusing you, being rude, interrupting you, which I'm doing to you all the time, you know. So that's the bit that I think we need to change.
It is, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that, you know, certainly what we're seeing in and hearing from workplaces is that actually that is more challenging now than it ever has been for all sorts of reasons. Hybrid working. So our sense of being able to create kind of communities of solidarity and support are, you know, damaged because we can't physically see each other. And just even us talking about, you know, I'm not in the room with you. It fundamentally changes conversations, relationships, etc. So we're having to rethink workplaces now. We're having to rethink the relationship between workforce and leaders because all of the conditions have changed. So navigating that space, I think, is tough for us right now. And I don't know that we're having the proper conversations about what happened during the pandemic and how we've recovered or not. The horrifically volatile political situation. So all of that, it feels like at the moment we've got a lot of baggage we have to discharge before we can start to really heal and think about the future of mental health in the country properly.
Yeah, it's such a big issue, isn't it? But just coming back to the culture at Mind, I mean, I always ask these questions of people when they come on this show, one of which is about, well, how do you change the culture? And it's all people, what's the one thing that you could do that would change the culture in your organization? And people struggle with it because it's really hard to answer that question. And I stole this idea from somebody else, actually, so it's not mine. I'm not telling you who it was because I can't remember. But it's, you have to get a CEO to come out with mental health issues and express their vulnerabilities, because that gives permission to everybody in the organization and exposes the board for being a lack of compassion if they behave in a certain way. So it helps them, it helps everybody in the organization. And it's, I wanted to mention that to you without asking you the question, because you are a CEO and you have admitted vulnerabilities and stuff. What's that done to the culture of Mind?
Well, it's interesting because we definitely know that there are two big things that have an impact on stigma and positive culture. And one is having social contact with people with mental illness, so really making sure there's no boundaries or obstacles. And the second one is leaders sharing their vulnerability where possible. And I think that where I've done it, and certainly at Mind, because I first started sharing my own experience some years ago, and I wrote a blog about I experienced postnatal depression, for instance, which was horrific, and writing about that was very cathartic, and the response was really positive within my organization and within my peer group, you know, people saying, oh, actually, I experienced that too, but I couldn't tell anyone. And I think I work in mental health, right? So it should be easy for me.
It should
easier
be
easier.
But that's not the same for everybody, though, is it?
It's
even
not
if
the
they're
same
working
for
in mental health.
So my experience is slightly you know, slightly out from, you know, the norm of leadership, you know. So when I did disclose at Mind, I got the response that you would expect, which is understanding, compassion, engagement, respect, shared disclosure, you know, and so and integrity. You know, people felt like, okay, this is somebody who knows what they're talking about and who is coming from a place of compassion. But I've also spoken to people, you and others, who will have said, look, I disclosed and that was it.
Yeah,
you know,
the majority actually, don't they? They either lose their job or they get pushed sideways or something. And you know, if you're young, and I think about my kids, and I've now just got a granddaughter as well, so I'm thinking about her for the next however long it is. How do you deal with that without compromising your career? If you, my eldest son particularly is quite ambitious, and I know he lives with mental health issues as well, as does my other younger son as well, but him admitting that at work would potentially be a disaster.
Yeah.
That people would still be compassionate, they would still express all the right words, but actually they're thinking, hold on a minute, you know, poor old this chap, he's got mental health, we can't push him too far, we need to put him into something a bit softer, we need to look after him, which is great, but actually it's not so much that, it's about protecting them and supporting them to deliver what they are actually capable of doing. Isn't it?
Indeed. And I think, look, you know, this is why the work has begun. It's not done. You know, issues of stigma are still rife. We're seeing a bit of a rollback in attitudes and behaviours. So we definitely know it's true. And when the country, we see this all around the world, when we're under pressure, certainly financial pressure, attitudes harden. Okay, so we're in a much more hostile environment now than we have been over the last 10 years, if you like.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that hopefully your son's generation are much more emotionally intelligent. And so there is something about it's much more unattractive and unappealing now if you hold a position of you know, stigma or feeling somebody is weak or they're not able to. So we've got a lot of levers in our control, but it does demand, I do think leaders in all environments have a duty to share their humanity with their workforce.
Oh God, wouldn't that be good? Wouldn't
so
that
it's
be good?
Not necessarily, you might just to demonstrate or to create an environment where, you know, people are held and supported. You don't need to necessarily disclose, I've got this, I've got that, or I've lived with that. Although that would be wonderful.
Yeah, it would.
And my preference. But it's about showing your humanity and your ability to feel something in relation to what's going on. And I think if we have a leadership in any environment that's very much command and control, that's very much, you know, I'm going to cry in a locked room. I'm never going to allow anybody see me get upset. That's the problem. And that's harking back to a kind of, you know, 50s, 60s style of leadership that we are starting to understand does not work in today's environment. It just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. And I look at, I mean, you we'll probably come on to the discrimination and privilege and all of those sorts of things in a minute. But if you look at most boards of the big organisations, the diversity is pretty poor. They're all white, grey-haired, probably older, middle class or above, you know. And they've come up through a culture where their behaviours that they're demonstrating now were prevalent then. And that's how they got on and succeeded, because they behaved in the same way that the culture allowed them to behave. And unfortunately, it's still happening down. There's a sort of groundswell of opinion that's changing that. But actually, there's still this wave of bullying that goes on.
And often you find that, you know, we think about that in particular. So NHS, for instance, you find that the NHS has a great deal of bullying across all levels, in all environments. You often, and these are all very fascinating situations, and it's always struck me as, why is it that we find when we get a lot of people together that this naturally and inevitably happens. What are the things, what are the levers that we can pull that fundamentally stop those behaviours in their tracks? And of course, it's about talking about values and it's about behaviours. But for us at Mind, and it's about accountability. It's about, well, actually, these are the behaviours we expect. If you don't adhere to them, there are consequences. And for us to all kind of be really clear about that. And so things like, how do we speak to each other in emails? How do we speak to each other when we don't agree? Can we deal with conflict appropriately? You know, I just am astonished at the level of bullying and harassment across organizations. And often the worst happens in environments where you think we should be the most caring. And that is a peculiarity.
Yeah.
And one that I think speaks to the level of stress and pressure that people are under.
I think that's the key, isn't it? It's about the stress that people are under, because human nature is, if you're under stress and you continue to get pushed, you will fight back. You'll lose your temper. You'll explode. You'll be rude. You'll just say, well, fuck off then, or something, you know. And that's, I don't think you can stop that. But then it's about dealing with the people's pressure, isn't it? It's about not putting them under pressure, or putting them under the amount of pressure that they can handle without having to venture into bad behavior.
Absolutely. And I think that's the challenge that organizations, and you know, I would include Mind in that, that, you know, in these times where resources are strapped but need is so great, how do you manage the tension between making sure your workforce is not pushed too far versus we have to meet the needs of millions and millions of people who are struggling?
Yeah.
And, you know, well, I go to sleep.
There's no obvious answer. I despair. I honestly despair for my kids and, you know, grandchildren and so on, because there's just, I cannot see a way out of that.
It's painful. So I go to bed every night, and this is the sort of state of play for most of us, I think, who are in the business of care, which is, you know, I go to bed every night thinking about the people we haven't helped versus the people we've helped. And that's because I'm striving all the time to make sure that we can do the best that we can, etc. Now, I don't believe it's hopeless, right? I don't believe it's hopeless. But I do think this government and this new government will need to really pull some strings that are within their gift, that absolutely are within their gift, to change the trajectory. So if we look at mental health, for instance, it's my view, and it's the view of, you know, many of the academics and the people who run charities and the people with lived experience themselves, if we could do something really big on poverty, we would see a huge decline in mental illness. We saw a 6% increase in suicide in the last year. That is the biggest rise since 1999.
That is desperate.
It is. And we know the reasons why. We know that the cost of living is a significant driver for people in terms of their mental health. Mm. So let's tackle that. Let's really get our weight behind. Okay, we need welfare reform. We need things like, and I know that this isn't necessarily a very popular one, but I'm afraid it's the reality, that we need to disband the child benefit cap. Because that has thrown 500,000 children into poverty.
Is that,
overnight?
That's the
child benefit.
Yeah,
so for two children.
For two children, but also for double incomes, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So all of that, you know, that immediately,
yeah, that's just unfair,
threw children into poverty in a way that was so deeply shocking. We've got, I mean, I'm great friends with Emma, who runs the Trussell Trust, which is the food banks around the country. And her, I mean, you must talk to her at some point. She's a beautiful human being. But she will say to you, we should not exist.
No, that's true. You have, your objective, I guess, at Mind as well,
and
is
Mind,
to make yourself redundant.
Absolutely. That is our primary focus. There are aspects of our work that may always, because in mental health terms, Some mental illness is organic and is, you know, comes from your body.
Yeah, it's
other people, yeah. And the majority of people, it is a result of external factors. So for us, much of our work would disappear overnight if we eradicated poverty. So much of the problems we see in terms of the interface between the police and the public would be resolved if we dealt with racism.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, you're in such a position of influence, and I'm not, and I'm frustrated by that, because it's like what was it, the LGBT rights movement that started with Stonewall, was it Stonewall, I think, and
yes.
And Rosa Parks for Black Civil Rights in America, all this. It's that one single moment that triggers a whole change in direction, and that. Solving the poverty, or getting that right, getting rid of that, would, I think you're right, it would change everything immeasurably.
It would. And when we think about, you know, 14 years of austerity, which decimated community resources, it decimated our ability to support children, young people outside of school. It decimated health and well-being opportunities, you know, those things that keep people well and out of hospital. It decimated our prevention agenda. And we are now seeing the consequences of that. So we have now got 14 years worth of decline that we're having to kind of mop up and fix. And it absolutely evidences and demonstrates why taking money out of communities is going to cost countries big, big, big in
yeah,
the end.
Yeah, because the cost,
you know,
of...
Because sorry, it's sorry, quite clear. I think we can see it now.
It
we
is.
Don't need a degree in economics to see
no.
it.
No, but I mean, there's some research by Deloitte a few years back who said that if for every pound you spend on mental health care of your workforce, you get £5 back. And there's, you know, whether it's £3 or £10, it doesn't matter. The point is the business case is really, really proven. And some organisations are doing that. But there's a contradiction, isn't there, between what they're trying to do to look after their staff, which is the right thing to do, and then ticking boxes because that's what they have to do, and shareholders who probably live abroad don't give a toss. All they want to do is see a return on money. So there's that conflict between, well, I guess it's socialism and capitalism, actually, in its blandest sense, isn't it?
It is. It is, and it's really tricky because it feels like, you know, the economic argument, like you say, is really strong. It's really strong, and the Centre for Mental Health recently redid the figures to say that in 2020... mental illness cost the country 117 billion.
Yeah.
It now costs 300 billion. And that's in lost work time, presenteeism, corrosive impact on our country's health and well-being as a kind of nation.
Yeah.
And I think you can't underplay that. You know, this is real. This is very real. And so the government has a great opportunity now to kind of shift that dial. We've got very simple things that can happen really quickly. So, you know, we've got well worked out plans for, you know, okay, what if we wanted to deal with poverty? Well, these are the five things that you can do that would impact poverty. One of the things that we're really concerned about is the waiting lists. We've got 2 million people on the waiting list.
That's
for
ridiculous
mental health
number.
Support.
I'm frustrated by this. Yeah, they do. They can't wait. You know, if you've got somebody who is desperate.
But you will not hear them. You know, when you hear the narrative about waiting lists, and you'll hear elective waiting lists, that does include people with mental health problems, but nobody's equating those. So we've got people living for maybe up to 2 years in some cases on a waiting list. So by the time they get to the service, their health is degraded, they need more support.
It could be too late.
They might have already lost their job.
Well, they might have already lost their life as well, mightn't they?
Might already have lost their life.
You know, so it's too late. It's too late by then. So I don't know how to... I don't know what the next question is, really, because this is such an interesting... area to talk about, I'll go back to behaviour at work, because that's something that I'm particularly interested in. How do you deal with the bad behaviour at Mind?
Great question. Well, I mean, we've recently started to do some work around culture and resetting our culture in a kind of hybrid environment, post-pandemic, etc. And we've created a set of givens around, you know, what we expect in the workplace. You know, what are the givens in your behaviours that we expect to see? And some of those include, you know, open communication, expecting, you know, positive intent. So, you know, we want to drive out cynicism. We want people to deal with conflict rather than act conflict out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we put all of these things in. And for us, I think our approach is about calling it. Dealing with it quickly.
How do you do that? Because that, you see, sometimes that's quite difficult, isn't it? If you've got a bully in the room, and I'm thinking about one in particular when I was at Superdry, you know, nobody, and it was a few years ago now, but nobody called out his bad behaviour and he just ran riot.
And Chaz, you're so right. And that is, I find that unacceptable.
So do I.
And it shouldn't be on your shoulders or somebody who is at the, you know, rough end of that behaviour, to call it out. So I've been saying to my leaders and managers, and it's a really good point you've made, because this is critical. It is, if you see it, it's like that, But, you know, if you see it, don't wait for somebody to say, did you see what they said to me in the meeting? Do you think, you know, if you see behaviour that you're unhappy, even if you're not the victim of it, you as a manager, jump on it, deal with it. So for instance, if we see incidences of bad behaviour, we address it. We don't wait for the victim to kind of ask for help. And so that will take a while to embed, you know, because I'm very comfortable with saying to somebody, that tone's a bit dodgy. I mean, I laugh with the organisation and say, I'm from Finsbury Park, calling people out and, you know, having a bit of a, you know, tussle.
Yeah.
It's kind of like my nature. Yeah. So that's, for me, it's not hard.
Is there a North Enders?
I don't know. Sorry?
Is there a North Enders?
Well, exactly.
As in East Enders.
I mean, I'm a North Ender, fully proud. Yeah. And I actually did go to school in Hackney. So, you know.
Nice.
But yeah, that the deal is for me is that, you know, we have to call it. We have to deal with it. I think we certainly at Mind recognise one of the worst things you can do, and this is something we absolutely have to get a grip of, is hanging it out.
What do you mean by that?
Deal with it. Don't let, you know, investigations can go on for weeks, months, you know,
in
bureaucracy
the
can get in the way of dealing with problems. Employment law can get in the way, ironically, of dealing with problems because it's so bureaucratic.
You have to go through a procedure, don't you?
If we can create the conditions for people to talk to each other, that should go some way to improving things.
Yeah. Would you do it in the moment?
Yes.
Would you? Because when I was at Superdry, all right, you know, it used to happen once a month. You know, you prepare for a board meeting and then you get beaten up and then you prepare for the next one. Yeah, so you think, oh, you're always on edge. And it shouldn't be up to the person to call it out. But I did, right? I went to the chairman and I said, look, I'm quite happy being challenged, but does he have to behave like such a twat? Mm-hmm. Right? Now, he had a word with him, actually, fair dues, afterwards. And the next meeting, he was very strange, right? You know, he was obviously trying to be nice. And then the meeting after that, he reverted back to type. Nobody bloody said a word. And you think, and this is you about leaving it hanging. It was left hanging. And this particular person wasn't called up enough or again for the same behaviour. You know,
well, a great friend of mine, John Amici, who I think is amazing, he does lots of leadership stuff. He basically says that the worst behaviour in organisations is tolerated by the chief executive. So from my perspective, I'm like, when I first heard him say that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so true.
You've got a chairman as well, haven't you? You've got a chairman. Is it Susie? Your
Stevie.
Chairman. Stevie. How does that work? Do they have the same attitudes as you do? I presume. Yeah, well, they must
sure.
do. Yeah.
And we, you know, we, I mean, we're very similar, slightly different, but similar in many respects in that we, you know, we want an organization and an environment and a culture that has a bias to action. We want to get things done, right? We don't want to sit on our laurels. So we've got that in common. We also expect people to be, you know, I'm always saying, look, you know, work is really hard and what we do is really hard. However, we need to create joy and solidarity in the workplace. And it is absolutely should be on our job descriptions to do that. But yes, at corp, you know, the kind of call out behavior in of itself, though, has to be cautious and careful, because what there's a difference between call out culture and cancel culture.
Yes, yes.
And I want a call out culture, yeah. Not a cancel culture.
Yeah, you want it to be compassionate in a way, don't you? Even to the person who's behaving badly. And, you know, you just remind them that, you know, look, this isn't our values. This isn't the way that we sort of behave. Just have a think about it. You know, you don't go and bollock them.
No.
But you highlight where something's happened that they probably are not even aware of, actually.
Well, indeed. And often, and this is true, often, unless it's a kind of prolific situation, which sounds like your experience was kind of prolific, this person was problematic. But in many instances where it's like a one-off or it's just happened, you know, these things are because the individual's had a bad day or something's going on for them, and they need to be reminded, don't, you know, when you're having a hard time, you know, create your own boundaries so you're not spilling over. But that, you know, I think that it's really easy to turn a blind eye to bad behaviour.
Well, people do, don't they? They almost get embarrassed by it. You know, you put your head down, look at your shoes, sit on your hands, you know. And I now feel really guilty if that happens to me, and I will always try and call something out. I find it difficult in the moment, if I'm honest, but that's just because who I am.
Yeah, you see, you're from Potter's Bar, not from North London.
Oh, yes, I know. I'm the wrong side of the M25, you see.
I think there you are. I mean, yeah. So it's funny, actually, because that calling it out in the moment thing. And look, I can often do that in a way that doesn't create a drama. You know, I can maybe do it humorously or with compassion or with, you know, I'm curious about what's going on. Because, dear Lord, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know, so there are definitely ways of doing it. But I think that I also think that to let somebody behave badly on a continual basis is also a failing in your duty towards them as an employer.
Yeah, it is.
You know, because what will happen if somebody, you know, for instance, as an example, we might have somebody that's come into the organization continually behaving badly. We let them go, or, you know, on and on and on, because they're bringing in a culture in from some other workplace. They do something that somebody else gets upset about, somebody takes a grievance, then we have to dismiss them. You know, those are the possibilities of what could happen if you don't call it out.
Yeah, but there's a contradiction a little bit here, because if somebody's under stress, right, and they're under pressure and they care, they really care about what they're doing. And that must be the case with most charity work, I would suspect. People
absolutely.
Are there because they absolutely care. And if they get frustrated, they're going to bark, aren't they? And it's not done for the sense of any power broking or anything like that. It's done because they care. And that's quite hard, isn't it, sometimes to say, look, don't behave like that. But I care. I really want this, you know, because you're sort of... You're contradicting them in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, we have that a lot in charities for sure, because we're all fundamentally kind of activists and campaigners by nature, you know, which means we're all a little bit edgy. You know, charity people, by our very nature, are edgy.
That's interesting.
And that's because we're coming from a, you know, we are fighting here for the rights of whoever we're fighting for. Right. So, you know, we are naturally orientated to that way of being. And so you do find sometimes in those environments that conflict is heightened. So my approach to combating that is by, again, talking about it, by, you know, calling it out and saying, is everybody aware that this is part of the kind of nature of charities, or if somebody is overstretched and it's literally a capacity workload thing, then of course we will take and make reasonable adjustments. But it doesn't mean to say you're not accountable and responsible for your behaviour.
No, that's right. Because you can still care and behave properly, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Something I read somewhere, hope, compassion, understanding, tolerance are often built on the foundation of privilege. I didn't understand that. I've read it a few times and I didn't quite understand it.
Yeah, so
was that you who said that?
One of the things that I think is really, and I'll give you a couple of examples. So in healthcare, for instance, we say, gosh, the problems would be better if the nurses could be a little bit more compassionate, or if the GP receptionist was more compassionate, or we'll say things like, we need more tolerance. We often hear it in race equity work. I wish the black and brown staff would give us some time. We're trying our best. Now,
that's terrible.
It's built on privilege.
Yes, I suppose it is. Yes.
So all of that, you know, compassion. When I say, I hear them, we're talking about our nurses, you know, we need them to be more compassionate. Well, I'm like, well, you be a nurse that's done a 14-hour shift on your feet. You've been the only nurse on duty for all of that time on a ward where, you know, there are intensive care needs or whatever, or you're a nurse on a psychiatric unit. You're the only person there and there are three people that need one-to-one monitoring every half hour. So again, let's not talk about these things as an individual quality. How are we creating the conditions for those things?
Yeah,
employers and as an organisations.
I'm sorry, I'm being thick here because I still don't quite get the privilege bit. How does that fit? Why is it based on a foundation of privilege?
Because it's easy to be compassionate if you come from a place of privilege. Now, it's true that quite a lot of people who are not privileged in the world are some of the most compassionate.
Yeah. I think that's where I was getting confused, actually.
That is also true. However, what we tend to do in this country is we expect things of people who are vulnerable that are based on our own privilege.
Ah, okay.
Our own expectations of them. You should be more compassionate. You should be more tolerant of my, you know, journey towards not being racist.
Yeah. Yeah,
but no, it's okay. My privilege that I'm talking
okay.
about.
So have you read a book by Grayson Perry, The Descent of Man? I never understood white privileged man before I read that book. And I now understand what that means. Yeah, that basically the whole of the society, the whole of the world is based on white privileged men being in positions of power. And, you know, diversity, racism, all of these sorts of things come because of that, which is broadly what you're saying in the foundation of privilege, isn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So read it. It's a fascinating book. And man is in the descent.
The issue of privilege emerges in so many ways. And, you know, even just in our conversation there about, you know, pronouns or about disability or about, you know, we can use language in a way that people living in those situations can't. And I think that's, you know, when we're living in privilege, we look at other people who are vulnerable or who are different and we'll say things like, can you just be? Because if you were that, it would make it easier for
me. Yeah, okay, it's not so bad, is it? It's not so, you'll be all right. It's, yeah, you know, it's patronising as much as anything
it's
else.
It's incredibly patronising. And we have it all the time. You know, I remember recently talking to somebody about, you know, poverty and benefits, right? And somebody saying, you know, I do think it's outrageous that if you're on benefits that you smoke.
Well, how can people make judgments like that?
But we're riddled with it, aren't
we? Yeah, we are.
We're riddled with those judgments in society. And that is, you know, how can somebody on benefits get a McDonald's? You know, it's all of that rubbish that we're able to spout just because we're in a privileged position that allows us to make
smoke,
judgments.
Smoke or go and buy McDonald's without thinking about it.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I've I was in therapy for about 2 years, actually, which was, I resisted it forever. And then it got to a point where I thought, well, I've got to do something. So I did. And it was transformative, actually. And I then started listening to Michael Mosley on Radio 4. And I don't know if you are familiar with his work, is Just One Thing. Desperately sad that he died
very
recently.
Sad.
Yeah. One of the things there was look for kindness. Right. Be kind and look for kindness because it's all around you. So you don't make those sorts of judgments about people. You actually say, okay, that's your choice. That's what's fine. But be kind to them. Help them out. You know, be compassionate to them. And it doesn't cost anything, actually.
No. It's really important. You know, people often say the be kind narrative is very soft and woolly. Scientifically proven to improve people's mental health and well-being.
I love it. I mean, I was on, I can't remember where I was. I was going somewhere on the tube, right? And I was stood up. I was leaning against the back, the door. And I shut my eyes. And for a fraction of a second, I fell asleep, right? Standing up, which I've never, ever done before. And the doors opened. And some woman just grabbed me by the arm to stop me falling out. And honestly, I just felt so good about that. That just that simple little act of kindness changed my whole mood.
Absolutely.
And we had a lovely smile and a thank you. And that was it. We got parted, you know.
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy.
It's so easy.
So I'll probably leave you with this thought, which I've talked about a lot. We talk a lot, don't we, about the triggers for difficult feelings.
Yeah.
You know, there are triggers everywhere. There are triggers... you know, in terms of reminding us about difficult things we've experienced or things that set us off in all sorts of ways. But I've started to, again, somebody else told me, so it's not my original idea, but this idea of looking for the glimmers instead. So, you know, you will have felt it, that moment where she caught you and you didn't crack your head open on the platform.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that moment, that's a glimmer.
Yeah,
that's a glimmer.
But it
that's
stays
a
with
moment
me.
When you properly feel that, you know, just those great feelings wandering up and down your body.
Yeah.
You know, those that moment of walking in the sunshine, that smile with somebody on the tube that looks a bit frightening, you know, or I don't know, I got a free coffee in Pret. That
yeah.
I never get those free coffees.
Yeah.
I got one and I literally thought, oh my God, I love
it.
I know,
but it's so, these tiny, tiny, tiny little incidences can just change a whole day.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think,
the
glimmers. Yeah, I'm going to write that down. So, look, we have run out of time, actually. I've got so much more to ask you, but...
I know, I've loved the conversation.
Honestly,
thank you.
It's been great. Yeah, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. I've learnt masses today and,
great.
You know, I love the work that you're doing. I think it's fantastic and congratulations. Well done.
Thank you so much. And do keep in touch.
I will because I've got lots more that I want to ask you. So I will do.
Very happy.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Great. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thank you so much. Take
care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chas Howes. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on fubarradio.com.